Hey everyone, and welcome to this special soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This isn't the normal weekly news episode of the show. If you're looking for the regular weekly Risky Business Podcast, do scroll one back in your podcast feed. This is a soapbox edition, a wholly sponsored podcast brought to you, in this instance, by Thinkst Canary. For those of you who don't know, Thinkst makes hardware and virtual honeypots that you can put on your network and or into your cloud environments, and they'll start chirping if an attacker interacts with them. They're a low cost and extremely effective detection tool, but you might not know that Thinkst also operates canarytokens.org, where you can go and set up a bunch of honey tokens for free. What's interesting here is literally hundreds of thousands of people are using canarytokens.org, and Thinkst doesn't charge anything for it. It's free to use. They'll even give you a Docker container of the whole thing so you can run it yourself. So our guest today is Thinkst's founder and InfoSec legend, Haroon Mir. He spent a chunk of his career at the South African security consultancy SensePost before founding Thinkst Applied Research and eventually launching Canary.tools, which is the online home of Canary. And in this interview, we talk about what the industry is getting wrong, supply chain security, effective detections, and more. But I started off by asking him why Thinkst hasn't tried to monetize canarytokens.org, given how many people use it. And here's what he said.
So, I think the important thing is you start with Canary, right? And so Canaries are entire fake machines, right? So Windows box, Linux box, IBM mainframe. So if you're buying a Canary, that's what it is. And you're dropping Canaries on your network. But then what we found is the idea of honey tokens, like for years, people suggested you do it, and very few people actually do, because these things actually require infrastructure, like making sure the alert actually works, making sure the server's actually up to collect the callback. And so Canary tokens are honey tokens that people can actually use. Now, I'll explain why .org is free, but like the original version, we used to say, hey, Canary tokens are tiny tripwires that you drop, and maybe they're URL or maybe they're file. But actually, some of our tokens now are pretty complex under the hood, so even that falls away. So the smallest way to understand it is where Canaries are entire fake operating systems, Canary tokens are smaller tripwires that you get to tripwire your stuff with.
And it could be something as simple as an embedded image in a document that pulls from a domain that flags, hey, this document tried to grab this single pixel GIF from...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly right. So I think the two examples that explain the breadth of it nicely, the one is exactly what you said. So if you had this reliable, nondescript URL, and you get to embed that into Word docs or Excel sheets or PDFs, you can essentially give a PDF on every server. And when that server is broken into by the sort of attacker you care about, he grabs the PDF, the alert's going to fire that says, hey, this PDF that was on your staging server just got read. So that's kind of the simplest version of it. And on the other end of the scale, like one that I adore and use as an example all the time is the AWS access key. You go to canarytokens.org, you get an AWS API key. And the moment that API key is used, you get a message saying, hey, the API key that you just left on your code signing server 3 years ago just got used to log into Amazon.
This is generating a fake AWS access token, basically, that if someone tries to use it, you just get an alert and they get nothing. And there's no way for them to test it to see if it's genuine without trying to use it. And we've spoken about that one before, and it's glorious.
So I still love that token so ridiculously much because, if I was a defender, I'd have them on everything. Because even if an attacker comes on thinking these people drop tokens, what is she going to do? Not use that API key? Well, then score. You just made sure that the attacker never uses any API keys that they find in your environment.
You may as well put a sign, like a beware of the dog sign on all of your boxes saying half of what you find on here is going to be canaries, guys. So just so you know.
And so now they're not going to touch anything. And like if you take the AWS API key, and we've got several others that live in that sort of family, it's really fire and forget, which is really unusual in InfoSec in general, right? Like I know salespeople will probably abuse it to death, but if you take what went wrong with SolarWinds, right? Like everything else that's wrong about it, they've got a huge network to worry about. They've got lots of important servers. If part of their deployment process was to drop an AWS API key on every machine, now literally that costs $0, right? So it's completely free. But the sort of attacker who lands on CodeSign Server 32 absolutely has to try that API key. Because like how can they not?
Yeah.
And then you get this ping like out of the blue that tells you, listen, the API key that's only on CodeSign Server 32 just got used to log into Amazon. And it's super clear that you need to do something because you've got a problem. And so that's the sort of thing that tokens can be, right? And since then, we've got a bunch of others. Like fairly recently, we released one that's actually a stripped down version of WireGuard. So literally, it's just parts of WireGuard. So now you get a fake VPN profile on your phone, fake VPN profile on a machine. And what you're looking for is when you get Saudi'd or when you get NSO'd and an attacker slurps down everything, they see this VPN connection that says office or whatever, they touch it and you get a reliable ping saying, hey, listen, this fake VPN profile just got used to log in. And the thing that we focus on is it's got to be trivially easy to deploy, and then it's not got to be easily confused for legit behavior. So these are the tokens we build in general, and we keep putting them out. We spend a lot of time during the year coming up with tokens and then whittling it down to see if it's a token that has that magic, where like you can build lots of things that give you detections, but also give you noise or also hard to implement. But if we get the sweet spot, then we win. But it still doesn't answer what's up with tokens.org, because that's tokens and that's part of the product that we sell. When we sell Canary to a customer, they get the birds either in hardware form or virtual machine form or cloud form, but they also get their own Canary token server. Yeah. And with their own Canary token server, they can mint as many of these tokens as they want. And we've got customers who really use it well. Like we've got customers.
You've probably got customers who use their own tokens server and don't have any birds, right? Surely there'd be a few.
So very few with zero birds, but quite a few where the lines, it may as well be zero birds. Like a really big social networking site pays us like 20K a year. Like they've got like 20 birds, but they've got north of 500,000 tokens.
Yeah, right.
And so literally they're paying us for those birds. They drop them in their user environment and nobody's been in their user environment through all of COVID. But what they want is those 500,000 tokens deployed everywhere. And we don't mind. Like it's a good solution for those people and it adds value. The cloned website token remains awesome, but I digress. So we keep adding tokens where we think they make sense. All our customers get them for free. Then what we did is we take those tokens and we put them in downloadable Docker images. So people can build their own Docker servers and run their own tokens. And like hundreds of thousands of people have done that. Like totally just running Canary tokens, doing their own stuff with it.
And so this is a Canary token server. You've released a Docker image where people could just spin it up themselves and off they go.
Yeah, exactly right. And we've done that from day one. So, and we build them exactly the same and everyone gets them. And then like that, we take one of those and we host it free at canarytokens.org. And something like 500,000 people use tokens on that regularly. And like for us, it means that we get a few things from it. Well, one for sure, there are people who've heard of tokens, who know of Canary because they've used tokens. And so it becomes
a bit of a pipeline feeder, right? Yeah, I get it. But I mean, you're giving away a capability to literally hundreds of thousands of people, which is actually kind of unusual in this business, because normally, you know, a company would build something like this, then they move to the monetization phase, and you know, then it becomes a product. But that's not really how it's gone.
Yeah, for the most part, for us, like there's a kind of hippie-ish thing that I'll throw in there. That's something that I tell young people who join us a lot. Is and I suspect it's something you'll deeply know. Like you write a blog post and you get 500 people to read it, is the first time you realize that 500 people is a lot of people. Like actually you count your page views and it's crazy. And if you build a tool, even like at our previous company, like at SensePost, you build something, actually what you want is for people to use it. Like it's the most likely thing with anything you do on the internet is that people don't care. And lots of the time you build stuff and nobody looks at it. And so there's a part of it that it's just incredible that you can build something and like north of 500,000 people use it and rely on it. And it helps them when they're about to have the worst week of their life. And so in part, like we get that from it. But we also then get lots of people testing these tokens. We get lots of people using them.
Well, you get you'd get some real insight into what's becoming popular, what's working well for people. Like it would definitely help you with product development.
Exactly right. And you start getting interesting requests, right? You get people saying, hey, listen, we use your token for this, but what we'd really like is if your token could do that. Mm. And we go, yeah, maybe we should try that. But for sure, like, I guess everyone who does it will say it, and so you've got to take it with a pinch of salt. A big part of what we've done with tokens is just we don't have to charge for it. Like, we're making good money as a company. We can give that away free. And
it's funny, you're transparent about your numbers, right? Which is really unusual for an unfunded, privately owned startup. But I think the number you threw out recently was you've got about $11 million in annual recurring revenue, which is, you know, when you own the company, that's better than a swift kick to the you-know-what.
Yes. Yeah. So earlier this year, we wrote a blog post about our finances and we crossed that 11 million line. And yeah, it's definitely better than a poke in the eyes. And the reason we wrote it, for a whole bunch of reasons, but like Jason Lemkin, who's like the reference point for SaaS businesses, talks about 10 million as being this line in the sand. He says, like, if you get to 10, you'll get to 100. At that point, it's just time. Yeah. And there's a whole bunch of things that in his estimation changes after 10. And no, it's like, we think it's pretty cool. Like we've got customers with us who are with us from year one. Almost all of them from year one are still with us.
So hang on. While we're on this topic though, like, isn't there a temptation to try to monetize some of the stuff on the Canary token side, you know, to charge like volume licensing for existing customers who are putting this stuff into their consoles? I mean, currently you sell them one or two Canaries, right? Yeah. Little hardware devices, and they get access to the full commercial, you know, functionality of this thing. Surely there's a temptation to try to monetize this. I mean, it strikes me that it would be eminently fair to try to do that, even if you're going to keep the .org side free.
Yeah, it's a good question. And like I say, I don't hate money. Like everybody in the company likes money and likes buying nice things. But honestly, like for the most part, our take is that like, so we've never raised the prices on Canary in general, like since year one. Like the price that we set, we thought was a fair price.
What is the price, by the way? Because you are quite transparent about that. I just can't remember.
Yeah. So Canary is effectively the first time you buy Canaries, you pay $7,500, which gets you 5 Canaries and the hosted console, which includes the Canary token server. And after that, every additional Canary is about $1,000 per year.
Yeah.
And so essentially on our site, we've got canary.tools/quote. So people can go there, put in their number and get a quote for what it'll cost them. And like for the most part, we built the company behind our sales. So initially there were 4 of us and then 5 of us. And today there's almost 30 of us. And like my main take on it is we make good money. Like we make enough to do what we're doing. And so there isn't a crazy rush that says we have to monetize everything. Like tokens work and they add value to customers. And we don't have to extract every dollar from them for that. And
that's crazy talk. Yeah. I think some VCs listening to this just stroked out, actually.
Most of them talk to us very nicely about it and seem to appreciate it. And again, I want to stress that we're not complete hippies. Like we're profitable and we like money and we like customers expanding their flock. But mostly what we've seen to date is that the market rewards genuinely caring about value. And so we try really hard to do does this add value? Yes, we think this works. We want customers buying more birds. We want customers staying with us for longer. And so far, charging for tokens seems more extractive than it needs to be. I think
because it's a low cost thing, isn't it, to run? Like it doesn't cost you that much to keep it all spinning.
Yeah, most of the effort there comes from the research, like actually inventing really good detection mechanisms, and we like doing that work, and it gives us such a great competitive edge. We've had VCs interested in us and we've had strange takes with a bunch of them. A few months ago, out of the blue, a PE firm sent out a survey to a bunch of people on the internet as if they represented us, asking questions about us. And they then pinged us saying, hey, we'll give you the report. But one of those things, one of the benefits of those things is we get third parties talking to our customers. And we've had several people say they'd pay 10x what they pay for Canary for the value that it's given them. And for the most part, our take is, hey, that's awesome. But again, like, we don't need to raise our prices. Like, it's at this point, it's working. Like, that doesn't need to change.
Yeah.
So I think it's unusual, but it seems sensible.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, there's a bit of overlap actually in the business model between Thinxt and Risky Biz in that we keep our prices actually lower than what we could charge because that way we get to choose our customers, right? And you know this because you know what our forward bookings look like. You're in the loop on that. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like we could go into that extractive mode and wind up just with, you know, taking buckets of cash from mega vendors, and we just we don't do that. And we also run a newsletter that doesn't make a profit, which is a lot of work. And you do it because it needs to be done. You do it because it's good. You know, it's not all about making money. And like you know, this my company actually makes pretty good money. Like I live in a nice house. I've you know, never got to worry about money. So you know, we're singing from the same song sheet, Haroon, but sometimes I do catch myself thinking maybe I should just totally sell out and, you know, get a Lambo sort of thing, you know, that'd be pretty sweet.
I think I have two thoughts on it. The one is like the famous Bill Walsh thing, like the score takes care of itself, like you do good stuff and the score takes care of itself. And I feel genuinely in a sappy moment, I feel genuinely thankful because I think lots of times you do the right thing and you build the right thing and the market kicks you in the teeth. And then you maybe stop doing the right thing. And so far, like from SensePost, like I've kind of been spoiled that like we did what we thought was the right thing and the market reacted nicely to it. And so that makes us do more nice things. Because
okay. So this is the second part of this conversation is like you talk about doing more nice things. And yet, I mean, Canary's been going how long? Like it's got to be what, 6-7 years, something like that?
6 years, yeah.
6 years, right. So you've been running Canary with the same product for 6 years. And I admire your self-restraint in not launching more products? Because obviously, you know, you've built that one. It's basically an established entity. Of course, there's still work. You know, you're still innovating on it. There's still new detections and new tricks and whatever. And it's iteratively getting better and better and better and keeping and staying relevant, right? So that's where the engineering work goes, is to keep it relevant. But there's always a temptation, of course, when you've essentially built the business, you've built the product, there is that temptation to try to, you know, branch out into other things. And you have not done that at all. So the question becomes, why? Why have you not spun up something else? You know, you've got Thinkst Canary or, you know, canary.tools. Why not something else.tools? What's going on, Haroon?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's a lot more work to be done. Like I think in Canary and Canary tokens, which essentially becomes helping people detect when they owned early enough. I think there's still a lot of work to be done. And way long ago, we had a chat. I'm not sure if you remember, like 2 or 3 years back, where like I had this very rough thought, and I was talking about how I think people make a mistake by always asking vendors what's new, because it's one of those things that then skew vendors towards shipping new instead of perfecting the old. So everyone knows they can't just keep coming out and saying, well, we do this much better now. Instead, what they've got to do is go, yes, we're now doing new technology, and we're now doing Docker, and we're now doing containers, and we're now doing serverless. And so you end up with this horrible type of checklist development. Almost a month ago, we had an analyst briefing, mildly related, and the analyst asked us, like, so where do you guys stand with the MITRE attack stuff? Like is it implemented? And I said, no, like we don't do it. And they say, like, so when are you going to implement it? I said, I'm not sure we're going to. Like, I don't think that stuff really works for us.
That's up to the customers, surely, to figure out what detection belongs where and how that corresponds with their MITRE interpretation or whatever. Yeah. But it's become a checkbox. I see exactly your point. When you've got analysts, I'm guessing it was Gartner. When you've got analysts asking you those sort of, like, when are you adding MITRE attack? It is kind of everything that's wrong with the industry, isn't it?
So that's exactly what happens, right? And then every vendor knows they've got to do something MITRE attack. They do it, and then they do... They like the machine churns out, here's our blog post, we now do MITRE attack.
Although Haroon, I'm going to cut you off there and say one thing though.
Sure.
Asking vendors to put some thought into MITRE attack is probably, you know, this dynamic is dysfunctional, no argument, right? But asking vendors to actually do stuff that it with the MITRE attack framework in mind is probably the only positive manifestation of this dysfunctional dynamic that I can recall. Let's just inject a little bit of nuance into there, right? But I can understand also it doesn't belong with your products, right? So
So I'll tell you on MITRE on attack itself, like one of the products, if we had a bunch of time, or if I had a bunch of other developers, like one of the things that I wanted to build was this attack like thing. So I think there's a need for that thing in the market, and I think it's awesome that MITRE have done it. I think they can do more with it. So on a separate thing, I think attack on its own is awesome. But I think I think products that constantly do new things, there's this argument even for why companies don't write secure code. And part of the reason is because nobody gets promoted for refactoring and removing lines of code in a company. You get promotions based on shipping new features. And so the inherent bias in companies is to ship new stuff, not fix old stuff. And so nothing happens to make stuff better. Like, you get your promotions by shipping new stuff. And again, we, as a company, like, we are crazily focused on invention, like deep in our guts, we hire based on it, and we try to build new things all the time. But I don't think that should translate to here's a constant flow of features.
Yeah.
Because I think that becomes, it's a very easy trap to fall into, because you conflate that with progress. And I think, in a very crazy way, it's part of why the industry is where it is, because everyone hits the checklist items and nobody actually solves the problems.
Well, I had a great interview at the time of us recording this. Like, it only went out, you know, 15 hours ago or something. So I'm guessing you probably haven't heard it yet. But it was with Ryan Callenbo, who's at Proofpoint. And, you know, he was like, the whole industry is spending money on XDR, you know, NDR, EDR, XDR, whatever, when most companies don't have anyone to do the D and the R. And, you know, it was a nuanced conversation because, like, there's reasons for that. Smaller companies don't actually have budgets and don't tend to spend money on InfoSec stuff. But the point being that if you can crack the problems for the SME, you're actually solving a bunch of problems for the big companies as well. And, like, the incentives, it's always been a problem in InfoSec, hasn't it? That the incentives have all been kind of out of whack, right? I think it's something we've got better at, though. You know, there's more useful stuff out there than there used to be, but it's still a problem.
I'm not sure. Like for a little while, this is, if you remember, like a decade ago, I was all doom and gloom. And then for a few years, I was bright-eyed where I said the industry is getting better. Like, look, there's young companies doing better. And now I start to worry that those young companies get corrupt too soon. Like the joy of selling out comes too early before they've
managed to put themselves on a solid footing to avoid their stuff being ruined by the takeover party.
I think there's value in the craft and getting the solutions right and actually having those solutions trial by fire in the marketplace. Like I think those things need to happen to actually solve the problem. And again, like part of the reason we are happy doing what we're doing is because there's a part of it that's kind of like a privilege. Like I said, the first gate is you build stuff and nobody cares. Then you can build stuff and people try it. Now we can build stuff and make money on it. And now it's like, okay, like, can we actually solve it? Like, can we keep these customers happy? Do we save them when they're having an incident? And so, like for us, it's crazy cool. Like, we get the opportunity to do it. And then as we do it, we get the opportunity to win at bigger customers or to win with bigger problems. And like, there's a, this is a little more inside baseball, but I suspect your listeners will be used to me talking on your show forever. But like, part of the cool thing as we grow is we get to tackle more intricate parts of some of the problems. So like, when we started, there were five of us, and you on one side of Pareto optimality, right? Like, you're solving 80% of the problem with 20% of the work. And it had some rough edges, but at least it does X. And then you double the number of engineers that you have, and now you can make it a little bit prettier. And then you double again, and now you can spend time on this really niche corner case that most people are never going to bump into. But when someone bumps into, it's going to make them smile.
Yeah. Like, I can't believe they thought of this. Look, I mean, I see where you're going with this, which is, instead of just getting it to 80% and then selling it for $500 million and, you know, going Lambo, you can, you know, just keep going and actually make something good. And I know, like, anyone who's a Canary customer would know, because I've got one, right? And it arrives in, you know, the packaging and everything. Like, there's definitely a bit of a... you know, there's a bit of a Jobsian vibe to the whole thing, right?
It's love. Yes.
Yeah, but there was always that sort of, you know, almost Apple vibe, which is clearly deliberate. But that sort of premium Veblen product at actually very, very low prices, right? So it's, I get it. Yeah, it's about creating a vibe.
Yeah, it's, and like, again, like, to go full circle almost, like, we get that that's a privilege. Like you can try to be that guy when you've only sold 10 canaries and then you're an idiot. Yeah. And actually, if you manage to sell 10,000, now you can actually do that stuff. And so that's why I say, like at every level, like, we kind of, if we do it, we get the benefit of being able to do it a little bit better. And so, like, now we get to hire people who are way smarter than us. And like, it's just a fact that like early on, with all respect to our earliest people, like they joined us because they thought we were cool, and now the people who join us are like legit geniuses, and so now we get to throw smarter problems at them, and sure, we now have a company that we wouldn't get hired at. But like, again, it becomes, yeah, the main reason to not sell is because I don't think I'll be able to work at a company as smart as this anymore. But no, it's, yeah.
Well,
it's
look,
cool.
Let's move on from the, you know, from the talking about the business philosophy of Mr. Haroon Mir. But it was a very interesting conversation. This is our last special edition for the year, right? So we got to do that typical thing, which is to take a bit of a look back. And we're not going to labor this, right? We're not going to go too crazy with it. But when I look back at this year, the two things that obviously caught my eye were ransomware and supply chain issues. One of them got a lot of attention. The other got a lot of attention from us, but I didn't see it. You'd see news stories about subverted repos. You'd see news stories about, for the last couple of years, about developer accounts being taken over and then dodgy browser extensions being pushed out and things like that. So you see all these news stories, but no one really saying this is a problem.
Yep.
You know, this is a real problem. And of course, the SolarWinds thing happened and made everyone sort of conflate supply chain issues with poisoned updates, when really the problem is a lot bigger than that. So I feel like ransomware is something we probably don't need to talk about because it's, you know, barrels of ink have been spilled on it. But when it comes
For ransomware, I just think people should go read the NCC paper on. So NCC just released this paper on ransomware where they looked at something like 700 ransomware payments. And I was fascinated to see how the negotiation process works. I didn't know that much negotiation went into payments, with people getting whittled down from requests for 12 million to 1 million.
Yeah, it's very similar to the negotiations that occur between Somalian pirates and their proxies. And
It gives exactly that vibe because there's the thing that says they don't want to kill the golden whatever's laying the golden eggs, and so they absolutely know that they want the best they can get, but they also can't absolutely kill the person paying the ransom. It was fascinating. It's a really nice paper. It's nice work that NCC did. If nothing else, your listeners should listen to that.
Okay, well, I'll whack that one in the show notes. But I did want to get your thoughts on the supply chain stuff, because I feel like I've been waiting. So quite often I'll spot something, you know, as part of my work, and I'll say, this is going to turn into a problem. And I start saying, this is going to turn into a problem. And then there's nothing happens for 5 years. And then all of a sudden it's the problem, right? So that's kind of like, that's kind of the pattern where it takes a little bit longer than you expect. The other shoe hasn't dropped on the supply chain thing. We're seeing, you know, people using, you know, PyPI, you know, fiddling with PyPI packages to drop crypto miners. And, you know, there's just dumb stuff like that now. But I feel like this is going to become a problem at some point. I wonder what your thoughts are on that, because you've got, you've got a pretty good crystal ball sense thing happening. So what's your take?
It's interesting because I gave a keynote at Black Hat Europe in 2015. And one of the things I said was literally PyPI. And I said, listen, like, it's not even MFA'd at that point. And like updating libxsl is just Bob Ippolito's username and password. Like change that password and 30 million people are going to download a Trojan version of libxml. And unfortunately, like I've seen a bunch of activity in the space now, and mainly the activity that I've seen seems wrong-minded. Like people seem to think there's a point solution that fixes it, when actually what's causing the problem is that there's so much shaky infrastructure. And so I think currently almost giving it a name is hurting, because you're getting vendors going, yeah, we're tackling the supply chain problem. And it's like, well, which part of that's
kind of why I mentioned the SolarWinds thing, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff being sort of lumped into it, and there's, you know, all these different facets to it. So say there's 20 facets to a problem, a vendor that solves one of them will come along and say, we solve the problem, when really they're solving, you know, 1/20th of the problem. And this is one of the things where I think people in policy are a little bit maybe not as au fait with this stuff as they should be. I don't think they quite get how wobbly all of this is.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. And so I'm laughing just because it's gonna lead to such a vendor pitch.
I get it, because you probably want canaries in your build environments, right?
Like that's the take that I end up with is like, you've got to have detection. Like if your build environments or like almost as a side pitch there, like occasionally people will ask, like, so how many canaries do you think you can sell? Like someone asked, like, what's the TAM? And in honesty, like, we never did TAM calculations early on, like what's the total addressable market. But in honesty, like the way it goes now, our pitch is like, actually everyone should have a canary. Like even if you like a totally locked down network, like you should put three of them down, because you just never know when the network.
Are people using them in their build environments, like major vendors? Because I would think, you know, for a company like SolarWinds, it would have made a lot of sense for them to have some canaries in their build environments, right?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. And bunches of them. Initially, like I suspect early on, we didn't do enough education, like telling people what it was. And so you'd get someone saying something like, but we don't have that type of machine. Like, why would we want it? And it's like, yes, but an attacker who lands on your network doesn't know that. Or like if you take the SolarWinds situation and if you on the surface tell that person, hey, you should have these AWS API keys. And they go, no, our build environment doesn't touch AWS.
It's like, yeah, the attacker doesn't know that. Point. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Do your hardware canaries, support a profile that looks like it belongs in a modern build environment? And again, I'm going to say while we're talking about this, this is a perfect example of 1/20th solution, because we're talking specifically about detecting malicious activity in a build environment, not about, you know, the trash fire that is weak auth into critical parts of the supply chain. So that's a problem that we're not touching here. But do major vendors use it? And can it look like something that belongs in one of those environments?
Yeah, it absolutely does. So the answer to both those questions is yes. And part of our canary pitch, like for exactly that thing, is you've got complex plans to do around your build environment and all of that. Order 5 canaries today. You'll have them deployed in 15 minutes and forget about it. And if your build environment doesn't flag anything for the next 5 years, you're fine.
Yeah.
But if you get SolarWinds, guaranteed that person has to look around that environment, and you're going to get your knock that tells you, hey, listen, like nothing moved in this environment for the last 10 years,
but something
just tried to log on. Yeah, exactly. And so that's why like the canary pitch, and for this, we totally lucked into it, but like it literally becomes a thing that says everyone should have some. So to the question on supply chain stuff, then, like, I think there's some clever work being done, like Google's doing some work, and I've seen some startups doing it. But if you consider what we were saying about foundations being shaky, like, I suspect smart people have to come up with smart solutions. But ultimately, if you want to sleep easy, you need detection. Like, something's got to say, hey, this thing just did something unusual. And ultimately, that ends up being my cap-toothed sale.
Well, I mean, I think also that you make probably the only accessible detection. Like I mentioned that interview I did with Ryan earlier, yours is, you know, and everyone building detection and response things. I mean, when I talk about them, I'm talking about, you know, the more complicated stuff that feeds into Splunk or a SOC or whatever, you know, whereas Canary is not that. Canary is something that you can run on your home office and you never have to think about it. So a little bit different there.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's probably why like almost every large security vendor, I'm trying to think how much I can say, like it would be rare to find a security company that doesn't run Canary internally also.
Yeah.
Again, just for for the reason that says, well, you might as well.
Yeah, like, and it's just like $1,000 a year per bird. It's like, what costs that? It's crazy.
Yeah, and so far, like, that seems to be working. Again, like our biggest seller, if you hit canary.love or if you check our Twitter feed, today is literally just people saying, either I was on a network testing and it caught me, or people saying, hey, we used it and it caught stuff.
Yeah.
And again, like, for us, that's pretty much why we do it.
A product that actually does what it says on the box. That's very unusual and doesn't require a team of 50 and a project lead and lots of stress and heart attacks to run. So just before we go, though, do you think the supply chain thing, and I'm talking more broadly about the sort of software supply chain, the software ecosystem, do you think this is something that could kick off in 2022 as a serious issue? Or do you think it's going to be a slow burn that gradually gets clamped down? Or is it going to explode? Or, like, you know, what do you, because I don't know, man. I mean, this could either turn into a nothing burger or a crisis. And that's the problem, isn't it? When you try to make predictions, because it's impossible to know which one it'll be.
No, I think there's still foot guns in there. Like a quote that I've abused for years is from your old friend, Brian Snow, where Brian, in his deep, gravelly voice,
For those who don't know, Brian was worked at NSA for a very long time and actually ran the Information Assurance Directorate there and would occasionally appear on Risky Biz back in the day. But so go on.
Yeah, it's been a while. And Brian was profound. And at a conference in Malta, he said, and it was before everyone was comfortable with the fact that everything was owned. And Brian said, your systems continue to operate and serve you not because of anything you've done, but because of the sufferance of your opponents. Like, people just haven't chosen to own you yet. And currently, that's part of the problem when people talk supply chain. It's not that anyone's doing it right. It's just that people haven't done what they can do.
But see, that's what I mean. That's why I raised this as a topic, is because, I mean, I even think back, and it's a talk I've mentioned so many times, Ben Hawke's talk about how you would introduce very subtle memory corruption bugs into open source projects. And, you know, we're talking about, like, minor syntax tweaks that introduce serious vulnerabilities. And so this was his thing back then, is talking about how the open source supply chain, when it comes to, you know, C code in major things. I mean, that thankfully hasn't translated into a huge issue, but, you know, the fundamentals are still pretty wobbly.
It's still, nothing's fixed that. And if you take, I think it was last year, it's hard to tell with the pandemic because the last 2.5 are the same year. But I think it's last year that the university students actually went and inserted malicious code submitted Linux patches.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. I remember that.
And the kickback against it was not, here's how we can make sure.
It was, this, they did the wrong thing. They did the wrong thing. Exactly. Burn them. Which?
But fundamentally, nothing's fixed that problem. We still.
So basically, you and me are as one, which is whether or not this turns into a trash fire or not is entirely dependent on whether or not malicious actors can be bothered doing something with it. So that's cheery. And just look, final question, mate. You know, I've just mentioned the two things that I thought were the key issues of this year. You know, what do you think the key issues right now are at the moment, you know, both through 2021 and looking into 2022?
So I'm going to add a really strange one, but I think that the security industry currently has a problem because we're in a strange place when it comes to people in the industry. Like, people talk about a skills crisis, but I think we're in a strange place across a whole swath of problems. I think you've got some talent genuinely leaving the industry, and I think those are skills that aren't going to be easily replaced. I think there's some of us that need to age out of the industry because God knows we had our chance and we should be kicked out. But I think there are a lot of skills leaving, and I think Dan Gill warned for many years about the dangers of specialization or over-specialization. And you're starting to see that really bleed through nowadays. Like, we speak to young developers who have no concept of setting up their own MySQL server, who've got no real understanding of the operating system underneath. And it makes sense, right? Like, you don't
walk into understanding. Well, I mean, as we move to sort of serverless environments, I mean, that's a win. I don't think developers should have to know how to run a MySQL box, man. Like, I think that, to me, that's progress.
Yeah, so the thing that I think that's a problem there is, I think there's the world that everyone sees coming, which is the serverless world built on AWS and Cloudflare and Workers and all of that. And there's a massive long tail of networks.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this, which is there's not really going to be anyone left to handle the legacy issues, which is 80% of the world that we live in.
And part of the problem is that the InfoSec hotshots are all going to move to this new world because that's where the fun is and that's where the attacks will be and that's where the defense will be. And this other crazy long tail is still hanging about. And I don't know who does that stuff right.
Yeah, who's coming in to do that? Yeah, I mean, who's going to be a young 21-year-old Windows domain admin expert, right? Like, that's...
Yeah, And the problem is, again, just because I'm crazy throwing out quotes, like an old FX quote is that in a composite system, there are no gates, everything's a gate. Like, you just need a piece of it to be broken. And what we're seeing is hope in this new stuff, but we're not getting over the old stuff. And yeah, it just means that there's going to be this detritus that's going to get us owned forever, hanging about everywhere.
That's great.
And I think it's going to be
bucket of sunshine. My friend, you know, thank you so much for joining me for this long form conversation. You know, I really appreciate your patronage, my friend, over the last few years. And it's just always good to get your sense on things. And we'll be chatting, obviously, again next year. Cheers.
People look forward to it. Bye, man.
That was Haroon Mir of Thinks to Canary there, and you can find them at canary.tools. Big thanks to him for that. And that is it for this edition of the Soapbox Podcast. And indeed, that's it from us in 2021. We are taking a few weeks off. There will be a Seriously Risky Business newsletter next week, but no podcasts until the new year. I do hope you all have a wonderful festive season. And I'll catch you all in 2022. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.